Fads come and go, and nowhere more than in the world of weight loss. That's why Noom's weight management programs are made to last. Noom uses science and personalization to help you manage your weight for the long term. Their psychology-based approach helps you build better habits and behaviors that are easier to maintain. The best part? You decide how Noom fits into your life, not the other way around. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com to sign up for your trial today.
Hello and welcome to the Keeper Cup podcast. I am your host, Chad Young, joined as always by Pete Ball. And we are here today to talk about corner infield. It is, it's not as exciting as I want it to be, Pete.
No, it definitely isn't. Third base, you know, I've been talking about how thin third base is, it feels like, for definitely over a year now. But first base, too, as we were just discussing, it's things kind of look grim.
Yeah, it's just not as nice as they usually do. Before we dive into that, just a reminder that we are a proud member of the Pitcherless Podcast Network. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts. Make sure to subscribe, leave ratings and reviews. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Keep or Cut. You can follow Pete at Pete B Baseball. You can find me at Chad Young. Always happy to hear from you. Feel free to reach out and tell us what we get wrong on these rankings. 2 weeks ago, we did catchers. This week, we are doing first and third base. We'll get back to middle infield and outfield and pitchers before too long. But yeah, I'm so used to first base being deep, right? There's a million first basemen. You could wait forever on first base. And I feel like right now there's like the top of first base is as strong as ever. There are legit studs at the top of the first base position. And then there's like 15 guys who are kind of all the same and none of them are that exciting and they all have real warts and I'm sort of meh on all of them. And it's a weird, I don't know. It's a weird space. It isn't a case where, you know, for so long, I felt like there was no reason to jump at a first baseman early. You could, but like, why take Vlad or Freddie in the first round when you could get whoever, you know, 10 rounds later? Now I feel more like they're like five guys I feel really good about. And then I get a little bit more concerned and then I might wait, right? If I don't get one of the top five at that point, I might just be like, we'll just see what happens. But it's not a we'll see what happens because I know I'm going to be happy about it. It's we'll see what happens because I'm going to be nervous no matter what.
Right, exactly. Format does matter. So Chad and I really kind of tried to ignore guys who most likely wouldn't be drafted at first base. So that included names like Austin Riley, Kyle Schwarber, guys who next year will, I'm not sure if Schwarber will have first base eligibility, but I know that Riley will. And there's a few other names there that are really just names that we tried to ignore, tried to filter it down to true first baseman, especially since we're looking long-term, guys who are going to maintain eligibility at the position. But you're right. I mean, when I first started playing back in 2008, I'm trying to think of the names and it's like, obviously there was Pujols, there was Prince Fielder, there was Mark Teixeira, but it just felt like as the draft went on, there were still awesome first basemen. I think my first baseman in fantasy was Ryan Howard. And it's just a position that we've kind of taken for granted, but it has gotten thin. And I think part of it is as these older veteran, awesome names, you know, begin to fizzle out, your Miguel Cabreras, your Albert Pujols, and they certainly have fizzled out for a while, but there's others as well. Votto comes to mind. They haven't really been replaced by elite first basemen. I think that's ultimately the issue. We have this chasm between these veteran first basemen that have been doing it for a while, and then there's not a whole lot after that. So I'm interested to see how our conversation goes today, Chad. I'm in a gladiator league right now. Have you heard about these gladiator leagues on NFBC?
I have. They're interesting sounding.
Yeah, they're that's why I signed up for one. They're
you just dropped a starting lineup, right?
That's it. 23 players, and that's it. There's no additions throughout the season. Two catcher regular positions, five outfield, middle infield, corner infield, and utility, and then nine pitcher slots. And I've kind of been, because it's a 15-team league, I've been really cognizant of the positions that I'm drafting. You know, I wanted to take Devers. I wanted to take Marcus Semien to get some, you know, third baseman, second baseman. But now we're kind of deep into the draft, I guess. We're past pick 100, so we're well into it, and I still don't have a first baseman, and now it's in the back of my mind, like, man, this position stinks.
Yeah. Yeah, and in a format like that, you can't really go with some of the platoon bats that are interesting, right? And we're not going to talk about him today, I don't think, but like Josh Naylor, I think, is a guy I really like, and you can only really use him against right-handed pitchers. You can only use him against right-handed pitchers. He's a left-handed hitter. You can use him against right-handed pitchers. And so in a format like that, his value is really dinged because you can't put him on the bench when you need to. He's just in your lineup every day, and that's just the way it's going to go. And there's a number of those guys, I think, as you move down the list at first base, right? And at third base, actually, when we get there, right? A guy like Brandon Drury becomes interesting. He's at both of those positions. You've got, you know, Trey Mancini, who I like better when you can use him for his with a platoon advantage. You've got Jared Walsh, who I like better when you can use him with a platoon advantage. Like, there's a handful of guys like that, and they're just, you know, Rowdy Tellez, much better when you can use him with a platoon advantage. And those guys are way less interesting in that gladiator format. So it's an interesting one. But with that, let's jump into our top 10 lists. I'll start off by reading. We're going to start with first base. We'll go through our first base discussion. I'll start with Pete's top 10 first baseman for keeper leagues. And he starts off with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Not a huge surprise there. Freddie Freeman second, Pete Alonso third, Matt Olson fourth, Paul Goldschmidt fifth. And actually, I'm going to stop there for a moment because we have the same 1 through 5. So we have the same 1 through 7. My goodness. So Vlad, Freeman, Alonso, Olson, Goldie. Then we both have Vinny Pascantino sixth and Nathaniel Lowe seventh. Your 8 through 10 is Reese Hoskins, Andrew Vaughn, Tristan Cassis. I switched Vaughn and Hoskins. I have them 8-9 instead of 9-8. And then I have Anthony Rizzo as number 10. So a lot of overlap here. The only players who are different are Rizzo and Cassis, who we have as both have in our 10th spots. And then we flip, like I said, Vaughn and Hoskins. But that doesn't mean there's nothing to talk about at the top of these lists. And I think the first place to start here is Paul Goldschmidt at 5th. Because I sort of surprised myself by having him that low, and then you did too. So I'm sort of curious, like, why did we both have him so low? And I'll let you answer for yourself, and I'll tell you if I agree.
Well, I mean, it's pretty simple, right? It's age. We're ranking keepers, and although I don't think Goldschmidt's going to hit this cliff, and he was frankly being disrespected for a while in fantasy, and you and I stayed true to Paul Goldschmidt and kept ranking him appropriately on these lists, and actually we kind of underranked him because he performed even our expectations. I don't think ranking him 5 is any kind of disrespect now, but it just like any other player, and this isn't a novel take, I have a hard time drafting them after a career season. And at age 34, Paul Goldschmidt went out and won an MVP award. And the thing that maybe sticks out a little bit is, you know, 7 steals last year relative to the rest of his career. You know, that's actually kind of low, but I don't know if you can bank on 7 steals anymore. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if he finishes his year with 2 or 3. And if you're in a roto format, I wouldn't ignore those 5 stolen bases. That's not why necessarily I'd have him 5th. I just, when it comes to age and you look at the 4 names above him, it's hard for me to imagine that long-term I'd rather have him than any of those 4 names. And as a matter of fact, I think he's probably closer to 6 than he is to 4 because I view those top 4 first basemen so highly.
When I look at him, I think the thing that I struggle with a bit is he was, so let's start with this, Razzball player rater, just as a good starting point. He was number 2 on the Razzball player rater, not number 2 for first baseman, just number 2. The only guy ahead of him was Aaron Judge, who you may have heard had a decent season. It's hard to argue with that. And then I was like, yeah, but, you know, that was a bounce back year for him. And then I went back and I looked at the 2021 final player rater. Goldschmidt's number 14 on there. He's the first baseman on the 2021 player rater as well. Now, part of that is he steals bases and other first basemen don't, and stolen bases tend to be overvalued. So there is some, I think, some debate there about whether he's really as highly ranked as the player raters tend to put him. But then you go back to 2020 and he was much, much lower. He was the 23rd first baseman in 2020. In 2019, he was the 12th first baseman. So yes, the last 2 years have been great. And I don't think, I don't want to, and I don't mean to downplay that. And I would have him a little bit higher up if this were redraft. But in a keeper league where I do care about that long-term value, he is, I think, riskier than the guys ahead of him because we've seen him. And it's not, this isn't just like, oh, at some point he's going to age out. He's going to be, is he going to be 36 this season?
I think 35. Is that right?
Yeah, he's 35 now. He turns 36 at some point next year, but not till like September. Fine. Coming up on his age 35 season. Obviously an age at which players can decline at any moment. But it's not just that he could decline at any moment. We've seen the down years, right? We saw them in 2019 and 2020. And so it's hard to know once a player shows that decline, like, when's it going to pop up again? Now, again, in redraft, I'd feel pretty good about him. I think he'll have another good year, but I think the risk is higher. I think that for me is enough to just nudge him down this list. Now, to that end, why not put him below Vinny Pascantino, who, if you're talking long term, is young and super talented?
Yeah, that was definitely something that I kind of struggled with, but at the same time, it actually really wasn't much of a struggle. I mean, this is the balance when we're ranking keepers, right? Because so much of it is nuanced and your league specific. But if we were talking dynasty, where, you know, I can just lock a player up for the rest of time, then sure, I'd take Pasquantino. But as good as he was last year, he's got a while to go before he's what Paul Goldschmidt's been. And you're getting absolutely no speed from Pasquantino, whereas if Goldschmidt's speed does keep up, then that's obviously a huge advantage for him. So I would understand an argument if we were to say that we want to put Pasquantino above Paul Goldschmidt. But for me, I can't do that yet. Whereas the other four guys ahead of him, we've seen all of them put forward amazing, consistent fantasy elite production.
Yeah, I think the other thing that stands out about the five guys in those top five spots versus Pasquantino is the lineups they're in. And in 5x5, that still matters a lot in terms of scoring and driving in runs. Vlad with the Blue Jays, who are maybe not having the best offseason in terms of their offense, but are still a very strong offense. Freddie's with the Dodgers, who are still the Dodgers. The Mets are going to score plenty of runs. Atlanta just keeps trading for good bats from other teams. They just keep taking the best bats from Oakland every offseason. Olsen the last one and Murphy this year. Like, that offense is going to be great. The Cardinals offense was very good last year and should be again. And then Pascantino's on the Royals. And that is just, it's a big hit. And I think it shows up, like, if you look at their NFBC ADPs, you've got Vlad and Freeman both within the top 15, 11th and 13th. You've got Alonso and Goldschmidt in the 20 to 30 range, 21 and almost 30 for Goldschmidt. Olsen a little bit further down at 47, but there's a big drop before you get to Pasquantino at 90. And I think that just shows that, like, you know, to me, the sort of 1 to 1.5 round ADP difference between Goldschmidt and Olsen is probably close to fair in redraft. I think I'd have Olsen a little bit closer to Goldschmidt than that. I think he still could have a really huge season, his second full season out of Oakland. We'll have to see. But there isn't enough in the age, and there's too much risk with Pasquantino to drop Goldschmidt below him. Which brings us to the guy behind Pasquantino, which you mentioned as we were talking, you know, prepping for this episode, we both had Nathaniel Lowe seventh, and you were like, man, I was reluctant to put him there. I really struggled with that one. I struggled a bit too. And yet, I don't know. It seems like the right place to put him. It's where he is in terms of ADP. It is, if I look at last year's player rater, he was actually a little lower than that. He was ninth among first basemen, although one of the guys ahead of him is Brandon Drury, who I think is more likely to be ranked at third base. But why were you reluctant to put him there? And then how did you come around to that decision?
Yeah, no, it's both good questions. I was reluctant to put him there because to me, particularly in keeper formats, as awesome as Nate Lowe performed last year, like it just feels like a huge drop off after Pasquantino when we're talking about like upside and their potential range of outcomes. And I feel like going from Pasquantino to Lowe, that's like a noticeable drop off from 6 to 7 there. The other thing is like, I don't even know how to put it into words because he hits both sides so well. It just felt like last year, I don't know, I want to see him do it again, I guess. I'm not ready to make the plunge. His walk rate plummeted, which was weird. He has had a really strangely high, like extremely high BABIP so far throughout his major league career. And I'm wondering if that at some point is going to level off. I mean, he barrels the ball a lot. He hits it hard. And his line drive rate has been fine. I mean, in 2020, it was definitely an outlier at 36%. But I mean, it's not like he has some kind of batted ball profile that suggests he should have the super high BABIP, and he's obviously not a fast guy. He's 44th percentile sprint speed. So I'm curious what happens if that BABIP reverts a little bit, if we get more closer to what he was in 2021 and before that, as opposed to this like crazy breakout under the radar 2022 that has somehow shot him up the first base rankings because the rest of the position just doesn't seem that exciting.
So another guy who had a similar, I guess you'd call it a breakout last year, although really, he put up the same season or very similar season in 2022 as to what he did in 2019, is Christian Walker. Neither of us have him in our top 10. But, I mean, you look at what Walker did last year. Again, going back to that Razzball player rater, Walker was fifth. Goldschmidt, Freeman, Alonso, Vlad, Walker. Olson, CJ Krohn was behind him, then Brandon Drury, and then Nathaniel Lowe. And again, I think you and I both, you know, neither of us put Walker in our top 10. I think for me, I struggle with Walker because, and this is a little bit like what we talked about with Goldschmidt. He was so good last year, but we've seen as recently as 2020 and 2021, what the bad version of Christian Walker looks like. And it's a step down. It's a meaningful step down from where he was this past season. And even in 2019, when he sort of put up the same, I guess we'll say the same raw numbers that he did, similar raw numbers to what he did in 2022, 2019 was the rabbit ball year, right? And so those same raw numbers just weren't as meaningful. And so this season really stands out for him as something he just hasn't done before, and he did it at age 31.
Yeah, the Christian Walker one is a little weird. At age 31, he's a little bit younger than you might think. For some reason in my head, Christian Walker was older. I think there are some things that he did that might end up being sustainable. Like the strikeout rate was under 20%. And you look at the swinging strike rate, that plummeted for him. He's a career 12.5% guy, and that's only that low because this year he was at 10.2%. I say this year in 2022. His swing strike rate was 10.2%, which is awesome for someone who earlier in their career was just a strikeout fiend.
Yeah.
And was posting back-to-back seasons of 33%. So if he really has cut down on that, on the strikeout rate, and when he makes contact, it's thunderous, then like, sure, he could sustain it. But he again, kind of fits this mold of like out of nowhere guys, like you said, after the age of 30, not that Lowe is after the age of 30, but just first baseman who came out of nowhere, exploded on the scene with power. And it's like, are you ready to go all in on that? Is that real? Or do you want to see it for another season? And when we're talking about keeper leagues, I want to take guys with track record or guys who were supposed to have this huge upside and we're yet to see it. Walker, yeah, and to a lesser extent, Lowe kind of fit that mold.
Yeah. And I think with Walker, as I'm looking at him now, part of me, I wonder if I should have put him in there over Rizzo in my top 10 and maybe even above Hoskins and or Vaughn, because not only did he have that the power breakout last year, but as you said, he made big strides on his strikeout rate. He posted the second best walk rate of his career, and he had a 248 BABIP, and he is not, like, there's nothing in his profile that suggests he should be a 248 BABIP kind of guy. Now, he increased his fly ball rate last year. And so that had something to do with that. But if he sort of keeps doing what he was doing and gets more reasonable batted ball luck, there might actually be another level there. So I'm sort of, as we're digging in more on Christian Walker, coming around to the idea that he maybe should have been in the back part of my top 10. And I may go grab a couple of Christian Walker shares here and there. Cause I'm looking at this. I'm like, well, if I'm going to put Lowe at seventh, why wouldn't I be comfortable with Walker right near there? So yeah,
I would have Walker above Rizzo, and I would definitely have Walker above my number 10 in redraft
for sure.
I don't know. I keep thinking back to what you said of basically this, like, not much changing and just kind of coming out of nowhere. And like, yeah, you brought up the fly ball rate. It went up a smidge, like less than 2 percentage points. Like, otherwise nothing in the batted ball profile looks all that different. It's kind of inexplicable. So I'm curious to see if he does it again, but I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah. I don't know. It's worth gambling on as you get into this back half of the top 10 area, right? We talked at the beginning about how, like, there's this top five, and then it sort of was like, oh, I don't really know where to go from there. And I think if Walker's the guy you want to gamble on, I get it. Speaking of gambling, Tristan Cassis is your number 10. And this is, look, the guy's been tremendous in AAA. Can't argue with that. He's got all of 95 major league plate appearances. They were good. They weren't great. They were good. But you've got him already at the back of your top 10. So other than wearing your Red Sox colored glasses, what's pushing him up there for you?
Yeah. Honestly, I'm going to sound like I'm full of it because I have Tristan Cassis number 10, but I'm usually down on Red Sox when it comes to fantasy. It's kind of like this, well, if they're good and I don't have them, at least they're good. And if they're bad, at least I don't have them in fantasy. So I'm usually actually irrationally low on Red Sox when it comes to my fantasy analysis. It just came down to, like, looking at this blob of first baseman, right? This Rhys Hoskins, this Jose Abreu, Anthony Rizzo territory, and just deciding, well, if I was in a keeper league, I kind of know what I'm going to get. I kind of know the best case scenario of what I'm going to get from those names. But what is the best case scenario of a 22-year-old Tristan Cassis? And I think it's something that we may be underappreciating. Like, the Red Sox are going to suck. There's no two ways about it. But this guy's, because of that, I don't think Tristan Cassis is in a whole lot of danger. And when you look at his numbers from last year, like, it does look disappointing, for sure. But it was very limited plate appearances, like you said. This was a tweet.
I don't even think it was disappointing. It was fine. It's 95 plate appearances, and for a guy in his first 95 plate appearances, like, it's totally fine. It wasn't disappointing. It's more that I think it's asking a lot for him to sort of make a leap to the next level. He certainly has that capability, but I also think he could sort of do what he did last year, a little bit less OBP, a little bit more slugging maybe, but like similar.
Yeah. I mean, I would expect the average to go up. This was a tweet from Boston Sports Info that caught my eye last year, and I just keep thinking about it. He tweeted, players in MLB history in their first 70 plate appearances with more than or equal to five home runs and more than or equal to 14 walks. And the list is just Tristan Cassis in the history of baseball. And I think that speaks to his plate discipline and his ability to take a walk or to put the ball in play. And when he does, it's obviously hit pretty hard. And even with everything seemingly going wrong outside of the plate discipline last year, at least on the surface level, like, the ground ball rate was extremely high. His ground ball rate during his brief taste of the major leagues last year was 56.6%. It's like he was facing Framber Valdez for every at bat. And yet in AAA, it was at like 38%. It was like below league average at AAA. So even with all of that stuff going wrong, his WRC plus in those, you know, give or take 100 plate appearances was 120. And this isn't a player who's come out of nowhere. This is a player who was drafted in the first round, who has torn up the minor leagues, and now he's kind of arrived. Now, I made that mistake with Spencer Torkelson last year, but I think it's working in Cassis's favor that he has had that major league experience. He's not in a ballpark like at Detroit. He's in a ballpark like Fenway Park. And I just in a keeper league find him more exciting than these other blob options.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I think for me at number 10, I went the other direction, which was, at this point, I don't have enough faith in almost anybody else I could put up here, except now that we talked about Christian Walker, maybe Christian Walker. And so I just went with Rizzo because I was like, Rizzo's safe. Like, he, what he did last year is what he's going to do this year, I think. I don't think there's any reason to think he'll be anything other than what he was. And what he was very solid and useful. And so I'm more confident in him. Like, he finished 12th on the Razzball player rater among first basemen last year. I am more confident in him than I am in, even as we talked about the Walker upside, I'm more confident in him than I am in Walker. I'm more confident in him than I am in CJ Crone, Brandon Drury, Jose Abreu. Like, I just, Rizzo's just going to do what he's going to do. And I'm very happy with that. And at some point, you get deep enough on this list and it's like, I'm just not going to worry about the long term. I'm just going to take the guy who's going to produce.
Yeah, that's totally fair. Rizzo returning to Yankee Stadium was the best possible thing for his value, obviously.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, there's two more names I want to talk about before we get into our best value, worst value, and prospects. One of those is a guy we both have on our list. The other is a guy neither of us has on our list. Andrew Vaughn, we both have on our list. You have him at number 9. I have him at number 8. Andrew Vaughn was not number 8 or 9 in the Razzball Player Rater last year. He was number 20. So this is a pretty significant jump. From an ADP perspective, Andrew Vaughn is the 12th first baseman off the board. So again, we're pushing him up pretty high. This is one, though, you know, I'm starting to second guess, like, should I have put Rizzo on there or not? I have no second guesses about Andrew Vaughn.
No, I don't either. They need to get him, you know, permanently out of the outfield. Like, one of his concerns is obviously the launch angle, and it went down in 2022. But that also coincided with him putting forth his best season. His exit velocity looked awesome. He had a strong max exit velocity. With Andrew Vaughn, like, the only way he becomes as valuable as you and I want him to be, though, is if he starts hitting for power, and that means he's got to start hitting the ball in the air. But I'd be cautious to be super concerned about that, because this was a concern we had about Vladimir Guerrero Jr., and look how that turned out. I want to say this was a concern we had about Rhys Hoskins. He's a power hitter. So it will come with Andrew Vaughn, at least I think it will. I don't think it's going to hurt him that what's his name? La Russa is out of the White Sox as well. I think that could only help him.
Yeah, you know, there was talk last year that La Russa was really pushing them for, like, you know, pushing their power hitters even to be more contact oriented and stuff like that. And it's like, that's just, don't do that. Like, so I think getting La Russa out and having an opportunity for a different approach and a different mindset in that clubhouse is really going to make a difference here. I think having Jose Abreu out of the way means that Vaughn should be at first base and or DH and just there and there every day, and there's no questions. He has to worry about other positions, and so I'm looking for I think a breakout is coming. And I mean, just to put this in some perspective, he had a 327 wOBA last year. Steamer's projecting him for 338. So there's all, like, even the projection systems, the computers are looking at what's out there and saying this guy's gonna reach a new level. I actually think there's a level above that. And so that's sort of where I am. The other guy I wanted to talk about, just because he was inside the top 10 on the player radar and neither of us put him on our list, is CJ Crone. For me, this completely comes down to Coors and the fact that you really can't use Crone on the road. And I know, you know, it's weird. I've almost flipped the script on how I feel about Rockies players, because for so long it was like, oh, this guy's going to be in Colorado. He's going to mash because he's got the thin air and blah, 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 blah. And more now I'm looking at guys and I'm looking at someone like CJ Crone, and it's like his WRC plus at home last year was 132. That was a 400 wOBA. That is awesome. It was a 274 wOBA, 74 WRC plus on the road. And one of the things we've talked about in the past in the show is that playing at Coors not only makes you better at home, it actually makes you worse on the road. It is harder to adjust to pitches because they behave differently. And so I look at that and it's like, you get 81 games from him. You cannot play him on the road. Like, that is atrocious offense. And so the only way you can roster CJ Crone is if you're in a league where you have multiple first basemen or where he's your util and you have multiple util options. If you don't have the depth to do that, And first base is not the position I want to be doing that at. I would rather plug in a first baseman who I can really count on. You can't always do that. I get that. But if I can't take, like, I'd rather take Josh Naylor, who I think will do more damage against lefties than Crone will do on the road, right? Even on the bad side of their split. And so I don't know. That's my issue with Crone. I don't know if you have a different issue with him.
So here's the thing. I think Crone is super useful if you can stream him and only use him at home. But if we took him out of Coors, I don't view him as a top 20 first baseman. Like he's put forward some strong seasons in the past for sure, but like I don't think the talent is that great. Like when I look at Trevor Story or I look at Matt Holliday, Nolan Arenado, whoever, when they played in Coors, like I'm gonna deal with on the road and still get excited about them if they get traded outside of those places or if they sign outside of those places because the talent is still very good. I just don't think that's the case with CJ Crone. He's only had one season where he averaged over 90 miles an hour in terms of exit velocity. He's always put forward high max exit velocities, but he's never been this like, I think physically we look at him, he's like, oh, big bulky first baseman, must just hit for a ton of power. Again, he's had some power seasons in the past. He's had one 30 homer season. That wasn't even last year. That was all the way back in 2018. He's just not that good. So like I to me, Coors helps him because he makes him useful. If he wasn't there, he's not a starting first baseman to me in a 12 team league.
Yeah, that's fair. That's totally fair. So let's jump to our best and worst values. Your best value, we've already talked about, so I don't think we have to go into it in much depth, but you said your best value at ADP, which over the last month or so, Tristan Casas's ADP at NFBC is 239. You're calling him your best value. That, I mean, you have him in your top 10. If he's in your top 10, that's incredible value. So I have nothing to argue with there.
I just look at the names ahead of him. The three names, four first basemen ahead of him. Well, we won't even count Arias, but Seth Brown, Joey Meneses, and Josh Naylor. Like, I don't know. If Casas has every day at bats for the Red Sox and he's one of the top 15 prospects in baseball, how is he not getting drafted ahead of those guys? I don't get it.
Yeah. The guy I put up as my best value ADP, and I won't argue with Cass, I think, well, I don't have him in my top 10. I think at that ADP, he's a great value. But Josh Bell going a little bit earlier than that, his ADP is around 192 over the last six or so weeks. Cleveland is not necessarily a great stadium to hit in. But I think it's the best stadium that Bell will have ever played in for offense. He's been in some really bad ones in Petco and Pittsburgh. And so I think there's a big boost in there. He is a guy who has talked about hating hitting against the shift. The shift will be gone. And, you know, last year, obviously, he spent half the season, less than half the season, part of the season in San Diego with a very good lineup. But it was, you know, he was in an awful situation in D.C. with the Nats. The Cleveland lineup is not necessarily, you know, the best lineup in baseball. There's a lot of on-base percentage that will be ahead of him in that lineup. He is going to be coming up with guys on base all the time. And so I think that he's being sort of undervalued because I think people are underrating what an improvement his situation is right now. So that's me. I really like him at that, you know, just at the end of the top 200 type spot.
Yeah,
worst value.
Oh, go on. Well, I was gonna say, obviously, I thought of you when I saw he went to the Guardians.
I was so happy. I'm still so happy.
if Josh Bell, we've seen Josh Bell swing a hot bat. It doesn't matter what the lineup is. Like when he was hot at the beginning of the year last year, the Nationals sucked and he was awesome. Then he went to having, you know, Juan Soto and Manny Machado batting around him, and he was absolutely abysmal. So I wouldn't worry about his situation in Cleveland. To me, it's all up to him. If he's hitting and actually getting the ball in the air instead of maintaining that 50%+ ground ball rate, then Josh Bell's exciting. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. So worst value at ADP. I'll go with mine first this time. I went with Jose Abreu. He is the eighth first baseman off the board. He is going at 114. And looking at the guys going after him, so we talked about CJ Crone already, but I think I'd rather have CJ Crone than Jose Abreu. I'd certainly rather have Rhys Hoskins, who's going at 122. Especially after our conversation now, I'd rather have Christian Walker at 135, Andrew Vaughn at 143. get into Jose Miranda after that third base situation, but Anthony Rizzo at 157. And for me, the issue with Abreu is I keep seeing people be like, oh, he's going to love hitting in the Crawford boxes and blah, blah, blah. And like, okay, yes, that is theoretically true. He will enjoy hitting to the Crawford boxes. It is a great, nice, short porch to target. The home run park factor there, like if I look at Baseball Savant, the home run park factor at Minute Maid Park is 101. At Guaranteed Rate Field in Chicago, it is 124. Now, for right-handed hitters, since we want to be specific, for right-handed hitters at Minute Maid, the home run park factor, 102. Just a little bit better than overall. Guaranteed rate, it's 120. Yes, he will love hitting the ball towards the Crawford boxes. This is a worse park to hit in than the one he's coming from. Last year, Jose Abreu had 15 home runs. Now, he had 30 the year before that. He had 19 in the short season before that. But he's, you know, we talked about this with Goldschmidt. Like, Jose Abreu turns 36 in January. So he's older than Goldschmidt. His launch angle went down last year. His barrel rate went down last year. There's some positive there. His hard hit rate was still up, but I don't know. I think there's a lot of risk, and I think that his draft price is baking in way too much power upside for me.
Yeah, the power thing with Abreu is weird, because at the end of the day, you draft him for RBI and home runs, and he got the plate appearances and just didn't perform in those two categories. But when it comes to a guy getting older, there's a few things to look at. You can start looking at, obviously, average exit velocity. And Abreu's was way up compared to it was. Not way up compared to where it was last year, but it was up from where it was. And he's pretty much maintained it since the year before his MVP season. And it's not like the home runs disappeared because he hit way more line drives. He did hit more line drives, but it didn't really come at the expense of his fly ball rate that much, less than 2 percentage points. It's not like he was pulling the ball significantly less. He was pulling it about a half a percentage point less than the year before. So like, I really find the homer thing just kind of baffling. So I don't think it's necessarily a ballpark thing in either direction. I don't think this one's going to necessarily be better or worse. I just think he had weird homer luck last year. His whiff percentage against fastballs would be something that I would look at, like his age finally taking a toll. He whiffed a lot less. His batting average against fastballs last year was 297. His expected batting average was 311. So he's not having like your traditional, oh, this guy's getting older, he's having trouble catching up to the fastball, he's not hitting the ball as hard anymore. Like, those things are still happening. It's completely inexplicable that he had 15 homers and 75 RBI in 679 plate appearances last year. It's baffling.
Yeah. And maybe I'm just taking that too much at face value, but I am concerned about it. So prospects at first base, we've talked a lot about Cassis already. He's obviously the main guy. The other guy who's going to get time this year, I think, is Matt Mervis with the Cubs. Who knows what the Cubs are going to do, I guess. But as of right now, it looks like, I mean, if I go to Roster Resource right now, like, they have Alfonso Rivas at first base. They also have Matt Mervis as the DH. So they have him in the lineup already. And Mervis, I think, is an interesting prospect. I like him less than Cassis. He's riskier. He hasn't really hit major league pitching yet, but he actually has better AAA numbers than Cassis did. And so that's intriguing. He's also already almost 25, which this was his age 24 season he just finished, which is a little old for AAA. So maybe a grain of salt there, but I really like what he brings to the table. If you're looking for a first baseman to stash longer term, Kyle Manzardo with Tampa is showing some Pasquantino-like ability, and I think he'd be a guy. I don't think he'll be up this year. He's not on the 40-man, and they don't need to put him on the 40-man, so I think it'll be a little while, but I think he could be the next interesting first base prospect.
I like it. Yeah, I like Mervis. I think you're right, and Roster Resources, right? I kind of expect him to play, and the projection systems are interesting on him, where this is kind of the difficulty with projection systems, where if Matt Mervis is pacing out with 20 homers and 122 WRC+, then he's going to play more than 97 games, And chances are those other plate appearances, if he's maintaining those numbers, are going to be very, very good. So the projection systems really like Matt Mervis.
Yeah. So take a quick break. When we come back, we'll go to the other side of the diamond and look at third base.
When it comes to weight management, we tend to put our focus on what we eat. But Noom's approach puts the focus on why we eat. And that's a game changer. Noom uses science and personalization so you can manage your weight for the long term. Their psychology-based approach helps you build better habits and behaviors that are easier to maintain. And they help you understand the science behind your eating choices and why you have those cravings. Noom's personalized courses are easy to follow and will help grow your confidence with tools you can put into practice on day one. The best part? You decide how Noom fits into your life, not the other way around. And based on a sample of 4,272 Noomers, 98% say Noom helps change their habits and behaviors for good. Try Noom today and see the results for yourself. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com to sign up for your trial today.
All right, welcome back. As mentioned, we're going to jump over to third base now. And like first base, some studs at the top, and then it gets a little bit more questionable. We have the same top four, but a slightly different order. We both have Jose Ramirez first. You have Rafael Devers third and Manny Machado second. I have Devers second and Machado third. We both have Austin Riley fourth. And then we start to mix things up a little bit. So starting from fifth, I have Nolan Arenado, Alex Bregman, Bobby Witt Jr., Gunnar Henderson, Jose Miranda, and Matt Chapman. You have Witt fifth, Arenado sixth, Bregman seventh, Gunnar Henderson eighth, Chapman ninth, DJ LeMahieu 10th. I'm gonna jump right to this. I'm gonna jump ahead. When we get to our worst ADP value, Bobby Witt Jr. is the guy I have as my worst ADP value. And even though we've only looked at a couple of positions so far, I'm gonna go ahead and say right now that Bobby Witt Jr., whose ADP over the last 5.5-6 weeks is 7.45, is the worst ADP value in NFBC right now at any position. And I think it's crazy, legitimately crazy to me that he is going that high. Now, part of the reason that he's going that high is that he has shortstop eligibility for NFBC. So, like, is he really more valuable in NFBC than Manny Machado, who goes 8 picks later than him? If they were both just third basemen, maybe not. But 8 picks might be enough that he'd still be going that high. I just don't get it on Witt. Witt last year was the fifth best third baseman on the player rater. That is, now, I don't know how the player rater handles position adjustments, but he is shortstop eligible there. So he's the fifth best third baseman, but shortstop eligibility might impact that. We know that he steals a lot of bases, which we've talked about in the past can be overrated by the player raters. And yet he's going as the second one off the board, seventh player overall. And I just, like, I don't understand what people are expecting from him, because he got 632 plate appearances last year. He's not getting much more than that. He'll probably get less. If I had to bet an over under at 632, I would bet less. Gets dinged up at some point, misses some time, doesn't get to that many plate appearances. He had the 20 home runs and 30 stolen bases. That's great. He only had 82 runs and 80 RBIs, but as we talked about with Pascantino, that lineup is not very good. He had a 254 average, but he strikes out a decent amount. He doesn't walk very much. He's going to be very BABIP dependent on getting that batting average up, and I don't think he's going to. So I think he could very well go out and do exactly what he just did. And if he does that, that would be a great season, and his draft price will look terrible if that's what happens.
Yeah, I can't say I feel too differently on Bobby Witt Jr. I think in the industry, you and I are definitely on the lower end. I think for some people, it's as simple as this is a guy who went 20-30, was a top prospect, yeah, 22 years old. And this does matter. He's on a team that loves to run. So like, I wouldn't expect those stolen bases in the short term to be going anywhere. You know, you brought up the average and how he's going to be pretty BABIP dependent. I agree. And that's going to be a problem for him if he keeps doing what he did last year, where he was all fly balls. I mean, his fly ball rate was over 10 percentage points higher than the league average. If you were hoping to get more batting average out of Bobby Witt, then you need.
And it was that way in AAA, and it was that way in AA. Right. He's a fly ball hitter.
He just is, and the launch angle up at nearly 17 degrees. Like, if you want the average to go up, then you need him to lower that launch angle, hit more line drives, hit more ground balls, and there's just nothing that suggests that's going to happen. And so, even with hitting all those fly balls, the average exit velocity, the how hard he was putting the ball in play wasn't strong enough to really give him that many homers. He had 20. Now he's going to get older. He's going to get stronger and all that's great. But if you have a guy who's got a fly ball rate that's that high and his home run to fly ball rate is only 9.3%, well, you could say that, you know, maybe some positive regression, as people like to put it, is coming his way. I don't know if that's going to be as much as they think. And I think you could have a season of like, he's good. He's one of your better players in your roster, but he probably wasn't worth that first round pick you used to get him.
Yeah. And that's what it really comes down to. And that's where, you know, I have him seventh on my list and you have him fifth. The guys, like, I put Arenado and Bregman over him. You have Arenado and Bregman right behind him. Maybe I'm overreacting, right? Maybe I'm just so annoyed that he is being picked so high. And I'm like, no, I would push him all the way down to seventh. Like, maybe he should be fifth. But, like, I cannot see taking him as a third baseman over Devers, Machado, or Riley. And he's going over all of them. And I don't think I would take him over Arenado or Bregman. And, he could very much prove me wrong. I think he is more likely to have a little bit of a rough sophomore season and take a step back from what he was than he is to actually move all the way up to being a first round value. Like, again, on the player rater last year, he was 26th overall, which is either late second round in a 15 teamer, early third round in a 12 teamer. I think he's more likely to perform like a fourth or fifth round pick than a first round pick. Now, that's not to say I would wait till the fourth or fifth round to take him necessarily, but that's, I don't know. I just think there's a lot of risk that is that price just doesn't come close to accounting for. And so that's why I have him so low. It's half of it is just he wasn't this good last year. So I don't know why we're suddenly expecting that he'll make a big step forward. I can't see putting him in my top two. And that's what his ADP is asking me to do.
And what could really work against Witt is if stolen bases are a little bit more in volume and dispersed around the league, right? Because that's why he's going so high. I mean, it just is. Yeah. Like these early drafts, these draft and holds, these gladiator leagues, they force you to kind of commit to drafting like guaranteed stolen bases, which Witt Jr. is. You never know what you're going to get from Machado there. Devers is not going to offer any steals. Riley's not going to offer any steals. So I think part of it is not part of it. I think the entirety of it is the stolen base potential.
Yeah. I also think you mentioned it's a team that likes to run, but they have a new manager. So we're going to see what their style is and if it changes. Now, I don't think he's going to run a whole lot less, but I don't know. I just think you're asking a lot to assume that he's going to stealing 30 again. Like 2021, which is really his only minor league season, across AA and AAA, he stole 29. He was caught 11 times over that time too, which is not a bad percentage, but it's not great. I don't know. He was much better last year, but you're expecting him to be a better base stealer. I just don't see the path to improvement.
Here's the thing. Like the even if he hits 30 stolen bases again or gets to 40, like that's awesome and that's really exciting. But is that much better than, you know, the 40 to 60 more runs plus RBI that Austin Riley's going to give you over Bobby Witt Jr.?
Right.
I don't know if that's the case. Like you got to draw the line somewhere when it comes to stolen bases. Right. And I don't know if that outweighs it.
Yeah, agreed. The other guy, the other young player that we both have on our list, I've got a third young player, but the other young player we both have on here is Gunnar Henderson. I don't know. I think all the stuff I just said about Witt and like how do you get so confident when he's never done anything like a first round value before? Henderson has obviously not done even as much as Witt did. So what's he doing this high up?
Well, part of it's the position, right? We're getting close to the drop-off. I'd rather take Gunnar Henderson, and I don't know exactly where this would be, like the ninth round as opposed to Bobby Witt Jr. in the first. And Witt Jr. has a lot more going for him than Gunnar. Gunnar definitely a higher walk rate. Maybe he's going to get better, be better at getting on base. But as quick as Gunnar Henderson is, he doesn't quite have that Bobby Witt Jr. speed. But he is a guy who's capable of you know, potentially rattling off 25 homers and 20 stolen bases this year at a position that is really rough. What's working against him and why I have Ryan Mountcastle as my first baseman to avoid, or I don't know if I kept it that way. Yeah, I did. Worst ADP value at first base, I had Mountcastle. Is that ballpark for Baltimore is rough. And I could see that impacting somebody like Gunnar, who, you know, is not a massive power hitter, but somebody who could hit for power. I could see the ballpark kind of working against him. Although he is a lefty, so he'll have that working for him, but he's not going to go the opposite way at all in the early parts of his career.
I will say from a fantasy perspective, this isn't as, you know, it's not as true because of the much lower stolen base number. But Gunnar Henderson projects to be a better offensive player than Bobby Witt Jr.
Sure.
His steamer projection is a better projection than Witt's. His numbers last year, smaller sample size for sure, but his numbers last year were a better, more offensive value than what Witt provided. And I do think that there's an aspect here where I think he is a more complete player. He's not going to steal you bases the same way, but I think he's more likely to give you, I think he has a better path towards a better average. I think he's going to get on base a lot more, which means more runs. I think he's a better hitter. And so, you know, we'll see how that plays out. When I look at my list, it feels a little weird having them next to each other, and I'm probably putting them too close to each other. But part of that is that after that seven, Ramirez, Devers, Machado, Riley, Arenado, Bregman, and Witt, in whatever order you want to put them, we both have Gunnar eighth, and then man, it gets messy at third base. I put Jose Miranda ninth, and you have Matt Chapman ninth. I have Chapman 10th. You have LeMahieu 10th. None of these guys are guys that I'm like, oh yeah, this guy is just an absolute stud. Everything's great. The reason I put Miranda first among those guys is, I think a little bit like we were talking about with Cassis, like he had a strong minor league track record. He wasn't great in the minors last year, but 2021, he had a 431 WOBA in AA, 416 in AAA. He was a guy who a lot of people thought was going to break out and have a great season. He ended up having a very good season, a 117 WRC plus, right? That is excellent for a rookie. But if you cut off his first 60 or so, I think it's like 63-ish plate appearances, something like that, you end up with even better numbers. I'm trying to pull this up right now. But he had 483 plate appearances on the year. If you cut that 483 down to his last 420, so you cut off his first 63 plate appearances, he had a 134 WRC+. He was legitimately excellent, super talented, had a great season once he adjusted. Now, as soon as you say something like once he adjusted, you're getting into arbitrary endpoints and like, is it really once he adjusted, or were those just, you know, the bad 60 plate appearances and the good 400, and it's, he'll have those bad 60 every year and whatever. We'll see. But even if he doesn't bounce back, even if he doesn't perform like he did outside of those first 60 plate appearances, last year, he had a 268 average. He had 15 home runs and just 483 plate appearances, which would easily go up to over 20. 45 runs and 66 RBIs. He hit pretty low in the lineup. He should move up in the lineup. He started the season often hitting like 6th, 7th, 8th. By the end of the season, he was leading off a decent chunk of the time for the Twins. And when he wasn't, he was hitting 2nd, 3rd, 4th. He'll be in the heart of that lineup this year. And if you look at the 420 plate appearances, of those 15 home runs he hit 14 of them in that 420 plate appearances. Like he has a real path to 20 to 25 home runs with a good average, a lot of runs, a lot of RBIs. He's not going to steal you any bases. He's just not. He had one last year. He might get zero next year. So be it. That's fine. But I'm really excited about him. I think his upside is really high. And so this is a case where I think he is a risky play as the ninth third baseman off the board in keeper leagues, but the upside is big.
Yeah, I'm a Miranda fan. Back when he was posting those ridiculous numbers in AAA, I was trying to get him off pitcherless, well, formerly of pitcherless Dave Sherman in one of our Ought New Leagues for quite some time. I wish I was able to pry him. I put DJ LeMahieu 10th there as kind of like a statement. Looking at my list, I did have Miranda ahead. Oh, no, I did not have Miranda. I had Chapman, I'm sorry, ahead of LeMahieu. And I have LeMahieu ahead of names like Suarez, like Miranda, who we were just talking about, and like a few of these other guys, as kind of like a statement where I don't want to forget about DJ LeMahieu in drafts. And when I look at a name like Jose Miranda, that lineup around him is just going to be bad. And so when we're talking about keeper leagues, we're not talking about 5 to 10 years out. We could be talking about just who's going to be better over the next 3 years. And that's still an aggressive thing to say for DJ LeMahieu, who's clearly over the last two seasons kind of fallen off a little bit. But I think there's a really good chance that LeMahieu gives you better value than pretty much all of these guys, like Josh Jung and his basically 40% K rate, never taking a walk. And like, how long are we going to wait for these players? A Gunnar Henderson, a Bobby Witt, a talent like that, I'll wait. And you know what? Maybe I'll reach just a little bit to get them over someone I might feel is going to be better in 2023. But DJ LeMahieu, I could see just a consistent, safe skill set being better over the next 2 to 3 years than some of these dart throws. And so I didn't want to forget about him at number 10, but I am a Miranda fan.
Yeah, I think in terms of that consistent, safe performance, we both put Matt Chapman on our list. You had him 9th, I had him 10th. And at least for me, and you can tell me, it's sort of similar to what you're saying about LeMahieu. It's a totally different skill set, right? It's a totally different statistical profile. Yep. He is going to absolutely bury your batting average. He's not going to steal you a single base, but he hit 27 home runs in Oakland in 2021. He hit 27 home runs in Toronto in 2022. I would bet on him hitting something around 27 home runs again in 2023. And he's going to do that in that Toronto lineup where he'll probably hit lowish in the lineup. And so the runs might not be super high, but last year he had 83 runs, 76 RBIs. Like, it's hard to argue with that. So I don't love Matt Chapman. He's not my favorite guy. I think though, as you get lower down in ADP, like, he is 13th third baseman off the board by ADP. The guys, if we go from, you know, starting at 9th, you have Eugenio Suarez, Max Muncy, Jose Miranda, Ke'Bryan Hayes, Chapman at 13th, Josh Rojas, Alec Bohm, Brandon Drury, Josh Jung. I still, by the way, haven't gotten to LeMahieu. LeMahieu's 21st. But I think you're getting into a point here in the draft where you're going to have to just choose what you want. Like, Ke'Bryan Hayes, maybe he breaks out, but you're really just buying him for stolen bases, I guess. LeMahieu, you're really hoping to get just average out of. You got guys like John Birdie in there who are just stolen bases. If you're building a team where you need some power, Matt Chapman is you can get him as one of the last starting third basemen taken. And he'll provide you power and runs and RBIs. And that's a very useful place to be.
So I got to ask, because I agree with you 100%, but what made you go Chapman over Suarez?
That's a very fair question. I think for me, Suarez is, I guess he feels riskier, and maybe that's not fair, but you know, in 2021, he had just a 198 batting average. It was 202 the year before that. I know Chapman's not going to be great in batting average, but I think he should be a little bit better than that. Last year, Suarez was up to 236, so maybe he's going to recover some of that. But that was a 302 BABIP from him, and I don't think he'll repeat that 302 BABIP. He also had fewer runs, although more RBIs last year. I don't know. They're very similar to me. Chapman feels less risky. There's less upside maybe, but I think there's less risk.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't even know if there is less upside. Like, Suarez has the monster home run seasons in the past, but the ballpark difference between, you know, where he was in Cincinnati and where he is now in Seattle is so drastic that I don't know how much that really holds up. Suarez has had a nice little career resurrection, particularly last season, but I think I'm with you. I like Chapman just marginally more, but I do view them extremely similarly.
Yeah, I'm going back and forth. I think this is also one where, like, Suarez has, I think, more on base upside. Although Chapman walks a decent amount too, so maybe that's not even true. I don't know. They're very similar. They're very similar. And maybe as I'm looking at it now, maybe I could have switched them. Maybe I should have switched them. Chapman's a couple years younger. Maybe that makes a difference. I don't know. They're very close. Very close. So let's jump to our best and worst ADP values. I already talked about my worst ADP value being Bobby Witt Jr. We don't need to rehash that. But you just asked me about Eugenio Suarez, and you have him as your worst ADP value. So talk to me a little bit about that.
Where he's going right now, and obviously we're not looking at keeper league ADP because there's really no such thing. But where he's going right now in drafts, I think, is like the beginning of a tier. And so almost like by default, I have him as the worst value because I look at the first eight third basemen off the board. It's Jose Ramirez, Bobby Witt Jr., Manny Machado, Rafael Devers, Austin Riley, Nolan Arenado, Alex Bregman, and then Gunnar Henderson. Now there's a tier drop from Bregman to Henderson for sure. But to me, Henderson's in his own spot where like there's tremendous upside. There's stolen base upside. He could kind of be an all categories contributor for you. And then we get to the disappointments and the like guys like Chapman and Suarez who like, you just know what you're going to get. There's a very clear drop off. And so if there's a new tier, well, I don't want the first name in that tier. I'm going to want whoever the last name is. For me, that's DJ LeMahieu. And the first name in that tier is Eugenio Suarez. So it's nothing against him. It's just kind of by default. I viewed him as the worst value going right now.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think, you know, you and I are, I mean, at some level, just defining the tier a little bit differently, because I went from Suarez down to Josh Jung in ADP. So Jung is a 210 ADP versus Suarez at 147. LeMahieu's all the way down at 249. So it's a bigger drop off to get to that next group. And Jung, to me, I put as my best value ADP because I see him in a similar sort of 3 to 4 round range, 4 to 5 round range, maybe with some of those other guys, but with the most upside of that group. Now, Miranda, maybe I should have said Miranda at 157, because as I already said, I'm pretty high on him. Jung going more than 50 picks later, though, has similar upside, but more risk. And so I don't dislike Miranda at his ADP by any means, but I think if I was just going best pure value, I don't know. I mean, Jung, like, yes, he had that 38.2% K rate last year. It was only in 102 plate appearances. He hasn't really put up a large number of plate appearances in any season, which is a concern in of itself. But in 2021 in AAA, he had a 21.8% K rate. It jumped up in 2022, but we just haven't seen like consistent playing time from him. And I think when he gets it, I think he'll strike out at a lower rate, which I think will put him in a position to put up a more interesting batting average and gives him some real on base upside as well, given his walk rates in the minors, although it did not translate last year at all. So I just really think where he's going at the price he's going, he just offers more possibility than the guys around him.
Yeah, I like the Josh Jung pick. You remember we have Matt Heckman on. I know he's a huge Josh Jung fan, so I'd be interested to see what his take was on Jung's strikeout rate last season. But you're right. I mean, it was a tough spot, right? He was called up after an injury. He was supposed to start the season with the team. We all thought he was going to start the year as the third baseman. And I want to say he had shoulder surgery. I mean, I can imagine like, hey, here's what major league pitching is. Hope your shoulder's feeling okay. Go get him, sport. Like, I totally understand him having a disappointing season. So I don't mind rolling the dice with him at that ADP for sure.
Yeah. So we talked about Jung is my best ADP value. LeMahieu is yours, sort of for similar reasons, just depending on how you define a tier. Bobby Witt Jr. is my worst ADP value. Eugenio Suarez is yours. In this case, for very different reasons. I just think Witt's being way overdrafted. You're not even necessarily saying Suarez is being overdrafted. It's just if you're in that tier, wait till the end of it, not the beginning of it, which makes total sense. Then we get into prospects, and we've talked about some of them. We talked about Gunnar Henderson. We talked about Josh Jung. There's a couple of other names for this year that I think are interesting. And they're both in a sort of similar spot where they both play for teams where there's nothing really right now today stopping them from getting playing time. But if I told you that one of these teams was going to like sign Dansby Swanson or do something else and suddenly clog up their infield further. It wouldn't be a huge surprise. And those two guys are Miguel Vargas of the Dodgers, currently slated to be the third baseman on roster resource, and Brett Beatty of the Mets, currently slated to be in the minors by roster resource. But the Mets, I mean, as much as the Mets have done, like Mark Canha in left field has still been a bit of a disappointment. And Eduardo Escobar at third base was very much a disappointment. Dan Vogelbach at DH has been fun, but I don't know how confident I am in him keeping his job. Like there's some moving parts in that lineup. And any number of those guys could end up opening up room for Beatty to take a job. You know, Canha struggles, so they move Jeff McNeil from second base to left field, move Escobar from third to second, and move Beatty into the lineup. So both the, you know, Vargas right now today has the clear path. Hard to know what either of those teams is going to do between now and opening day. I listed Beatty on my list, and you put Vargas in yours. Do you prefer Vargas to Beatty?
I do, and actually for what you were just describing, well, first of all, from just a talent perspective, I like Vargas a little bit more. I think there's a little bit more upside there, a little bit more expected. Apparently, you know, depending on who you read, Steve Cohen is not excited about the offense. You know, like they made a lot of moves, but he still thinks that team does not have enough offense. And so I can't imagine the rookie third baseman who in a very short stint last year only hit 184. Granted, that was with a strikeout rate under 20%. That was with a BABIP of just 179. You know, I'm not like cooling on Brett Beatty because of these 42 plate appearances. But if you are Steve Cohen, you're looking to improve an offense, I think that's a part of the diamond that you put a circle on. And maybe that means Beatty ends up getting moved because all of a sudden free agency is really starting to thin out. Whereas on the flip side of that, you look at Vargas, like the Dodgers are a team that love to play their own young talent that is not going to go out and make some $400 million signing. I think, like you said, it's more likely that Vargas starts the year in the lineup, and I'd like to see him get a fresh start. He's just so good in the minor leagues, and you look at the Steamer projections for him, they're projecting a 122 WRC plus, 20 homers in just 130 games. And again, if someone's pacing out 122 WRC plus, 20 home runs, he's probably going to play close to 150 games, assuming he stays healthy. So those numbers could be even better. Steamer seems pretty high on young guys, on prospects this year. But yeah, that's where I'm at. Not as high on Beatty, but definitely on Vargas.
Yeah, makes sense. I like both of them. I think, you know, the interesting thing for me at third base when we talk about prospects is we talked about Henderson, Young, Beatty, Vargas. After that, it's sort of a weird position where like I'm looking right now at the board on Fangraphs, which is their rankings. It's not a fantasy ranking. It's just an overall ranking. But the guys that they have sort of after, they have Henderson, Young, and Beatty as the three best overall third base prospects. Then they've got Colson Montgomery with Chicago, who's very interesting, but is double A probably at least a year away, maybe two. Junior Caminero with Tampa Bay, who's only an A ball. Colt Keith with Detroit is in high A. Aurelvis Martinez is in double A with the Jays, but I don't think you get to see him this year. Brady House with the Nats is in A ball. Like, there aren't a lot of guys who are knocking on the door, unless you talk about like Jordan Groshans, who was a really interesting prospect not that long ago, but the shine has certainly come off that. And
for sure,
so I don't see a ton of super exciting third base prospects coming up behind these guys, at least not for, you know, there isn't anyone I would stash, is what I would get at. Because if I'm stashing a guy in a keeper league, dynasty, different story, but in a keeper league, I want to stash guys who are going to be up either late this year or next year. And after Henderson, Young, Beatty, and Vargas, I'm sort of happy to just let this position go.
Yeah, I'd say I'm in the same spot. I'm monitoring Austin Martin. He's a guy who, kind of like Groshans, his projected fantasy value has really wavered over the years, but he's a guy I'm keeping a close eye on. I know he's moved back up some dynasty rankings, and he's certainly close to making his debut. He's 23 years old, and I want to say this is his third year since being drafted. I'd have to look that up. But I mean, either way, he's a guy I'm keeping an eye on, but I'm in the same boat as you. I'm not ready to make the plunge in that position. If I'm missing one of those top guys who's making their debut already, I'm not stashing in a keeper league.
Yeah, makes sense. Totally agree. So we've covered first base, we covered third base. When we come back in a couple weeks, we're going to do something a little different. As you guys know, we've got a couple of listener keeper leagues that we've been drafting. One of them, we had some manager turnover, and Pete and I have been co-managing a team. We're gonna break up the band. We're each gonna take our own teams. But because we're doing that, we're losing a team we built together. And one of us is gonna get to keep that team and the other one isn't. And it's this is not an amicable divorce. There's a lot of talent on that team that we've been stashing. Team got off to a rough start, and we started to sort of focus on the future. And as a result, I'll just pull up that roster real quick right now.
It was very injury ridden. I mean, that was like Chris Sale, Shane Boz, and yeah. Jack Flaherty were our 1-3 starters.
So yeah, I mean, the team just, you're right. There were injury issues. It wasn't just that it was a bad team, although by the end of the season it was. But we worked really hard. And I'm just looking at free agents we picked up. Just guys that we didn't draft that we picked up as free agents. And Michael Harris II and Andre Jimenez, George Kirby, Anthony Santander, Nick Lodolo. And then you get into like Alexis Diaz, who's an interesting guy, Lars Nootbaar, Bryson Stott, who even in having lost shortstop, that shortstop position is interesting. Ezekiel Tovar, is he a keeper? I don't know, but he's certainly interesting. And then in guys we drafted late, we drafted and stashed Tyler Glasnow. I think Alejandro Kirk, we got him in the 20th round. I'm not sure what his ADP is this year, but he should be far more valuable than that. So the point is that the team that we worked on together has a bunch of value on it. And whatever team it is we get left taking over, it won't have as much value. And so our next episode, what Pete and I are planning to do is hold a draft. We haven't quite figured out the details yet, but hold a draft where all the players on our team and all the players on the other team that we take over are put into the pool. And that way we can both end up with some of these guys that we together stashed and some of the guys from the other team that we didn't want to stash. And then we'll go from there and figure out how everything sort of pieces together. But that'll take us to the end of this episode. Like I said, we're going to do that draft next, and then we'll get back into these positional previews and rankings and stuff like that.
Well, I got a quick correction to make about something I said earlier. So Austin Martin, just going back to him, we were talking about prospects we were kicking around. He was drafted in 2020, so he obviously missed the 2020 COVID season. He's been in the minors twice since then, but I was wrong. I was looking at third base dynasty rankings on Fantasy Pros, but Austin Martin's not going to come up with third base eligibility when he comes up. Minnesota acquired him as a center fielder. He's playing a little bit of shortstop, but there's no third base in his future as of right now, anyway.
As of right now, yeah. Although, who knows what that team might need. I mean, depending on who's healthy and stuff like that, I don't know.
Could happen.
We'll have to see what they do with him. We'll have to see. But with that, we'll let you go. This episode should be coming out on Monday the 20th? Monday the 19th? Monday the something. 20th, I think it's Monday the 19th. Monday 19th, the 19th.
Yeah.
And then we'll be back with you, which means that's it. You don't get us through the holidays. You're on your own for Christmas. You're on your own for New Year's. You're on your own for Hanukkah. We'll be back with you on January 2nd with that draft episode. So hope you have a good holiday season, good end to your 2022, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.